Hey folks, welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte. I'm a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. So the idea behind the podcast is simple. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, you can check out my website at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. So let's get going on this journey of the heart.
Our guest today is Dr. Kevin Wandler, and he's going to talk to us about eating disorders and medication and how all that works. Does it work for eating disorders? And how about the co-occurring conditions that can present along with eating disorder behavior? Dr. Wandler is a certified eating disorder specialist. He received his medical degree from the University of Iowa. He's board certified in general psychiatry with added qualifications in addiction psychiatry by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. He's been the medical director and chief medical officer at Ramuda Ranch for over 15 years. He's presented to U.S. and international audiences on the state-of-the-art treatments for eating disorders and co-occurring disorders. Dr. Wandler has written numerous articles and co-authored chapters in Eating Disorders, Handbook of Christian Treatment. Dr. Wandler, thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you guys today.
Great. Well, I hope folks are going to find this helpful because I know this is a subject I get a lot of questions about. Is medication effective for the treatment of eating disorders, and is it safe, especially if we're talking about teens? So could you talk a little bit about that to start us out today?
Absolutely. In the eating disorder world, there's really not a lot of medications even indicated for the treatment of the condition of the eating disorder specifically. The only medication that is approved by the FDA for eating disorder patients is a medication called fluoxetine or Prozac, and that has an indication only for bulimia. So for all the other symptoms of eating disorders, the anorexics, the restricting, just the binge eating, et cetera, there's really no medication specific to that condition. So my joke is at Ramuda, where I'm a psychiatrist, is that I don't even treat eating disorder patients. I mean, all my patients have an eating disorder, but what I'm treating is a lot of the co-occurring disorders. And that being said, I'll talk a little bit about that because that's what I end up seeing. I mean, today I met with several new patients at Ramuda, and the one gal presents with significant anxiety and depression. I mean, she has bulimia. Of course, that's why she's at our center. But what's really driving it underneath it is her extreme anxiety and depression. And so that's where I will be targeting my medications toward if she wants to go on them. She only got in last night, so I don't have enough medical information for her. But what I generally see is almost two-thirds of my patients have an anxiety disorder. And oftentimes that even precedes the anorexia or the bulimia. And in my world, almost 90% have depression. Yes. So a medication like Prozac or fluoxetine, I could be sort of, so to speak, killing two birds with one stone by giving something for both depression and if the client or individual in particular had also bulimia, I'd be helping those symptoms as well.
Yeah,
very complex.
Yes, I think that's a lot of what I see with the eating disorders. They present with co-occurring conditions, anxiety, depression, self-injury, OCD.
Yes.
So basically your thoughts are these conditions, when they're present, they get treated first.
Absolutely.
Because really, again, other than for bulimia, a whole lot in terms of treating the anorexic patient.
Exactly. What I see, unfortunately, I would tell you almost a third to half of my adult patients come in on medications for meal anxiety. And so they'll be put on potentially addicting medications like Klonopin, Ativan, Xanax, given to them three times a day with meals. And, you know, it's not the treatment. It's not the right treatment. And unfortunately, so many of my patients come in really dependent on dependent on the Xanax, Ativan, Klonopin. So I have to work on tapering them off of that as well. So it becomes very complicated. The treatment for, you know, meal anxiety would be similar to OCD. It would be exposure, response, prevention therapy, ERP, we call it, you know. And that's really the treatment. And so that's what we do. We monitor our meals and we work, encourage our patients to get through the meal and not just give her a pill. You know, what do you learn from that? Nothing, you know, other than you need a pill to eat. And that's not really the philosophy we have, and I don't believe most eating disorder experts have that philosophy either.
Sure. And you guys have a anxiety program, specific anxiety program out there at Remuda, correct?
Yes, we do. It's not at our inpatient level of care. It's down at our residential level of care. But we found, as we both have just discussed, that anxiety is huge in our population. And we saw a lot of OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. And so we felt that in the beginning, our criteria for admission is you had to have an eating disorder. But we were getting so many calls from young women that needed help for obsessive compulsive disorder separate, and they didn't have an eating disorder, that we opened that program up because we've become experts at it. Okay. I see about 20% of my eating disorder patients have OCD. For your audience, obsessive compulsive disorder is oftentimes you have an obsession or thought, and a real common one would be contamination, germs, germ phobia. And so the way to get rid of that, if I don't get rid of those germs, I'm going to die. So they do a lot of hand washing, a lot of cleaning, that sort of thing.
Yes.
In the eating disorder world, but I'm sure we see that our patients have a lot of food phobias and food fear, and if I eat, I'll get fat. I feel I have almost like 40, 50, 60% of patients with OCD. So we've become experts at treating that, and that's why we opened up the anxiety program.
Okay, so you use the exposure and response prevention for the OCD, correct?
Correct.
But you may also do medication, because a lot of OCD stuff is brain chemistry. So you just
absolutely. It's both. And the statistics show that the medication will reduce symptoms, we'll say 30, 40%. The exposure response prevention therapies will reduce symptoms, say, 40, 50%. And if you're doing both, you're more likely to get a reduction in symptoms, maybe 60, 70, 80%. And so that is what we're going for. I don't like to prescribe medications without therapy. And, of course, at Remuda, our patients get both. And so, and the medication may take the edge off to allow your, especially if they're outpatients, to allow Susie or Johnny to be able to come in for that kind of treatment. Because if they're paralyzed with their anxiety, how can they come in?
Exactly. So they need to be able to focus on what they're being taught, and the medicine kind of takes the edge off that. Now, for OCD patients, do you see eventually that they can be weaned off medicine once they have the therapy and kind of know what to do? What do you usually see with that? Or do they have to stay on meds for the rest of their life?
Well, it depends. It's individualized. I wouldn't say the rest of their lives, especially if they have a great exposure therapist and they're able to, you know, really take them and be able to get their anxiety scores. It's called a Y-box, the Yale-Brown Obsessive Compulsive Scoring System. If they're able to get those numbers down into just, you know, subclinical or just mild range, they may be able to get off the medication.
Mm-hmm.
Studies have shown that if I just gave a patient medication alone, and the medications we use for OCD are generally medications like Prozac. They're in that class, the SSRIs, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Luvox, Celexa, Lexapro. The majority of those medications are real helpful for OCD. And if I use just medication alone and say the scores drop in half, so they're just mild to moderately OCD, and we stop the medication, the OCD comes back. And so it really takes both. It takes that therapy. It takes that exposure work to be able to eradicate or at least be able to control the OCD. It is truly brain chemistry as well.
Yes.
But I think that the mind, you know, as we're working through the exposure, it becomes less intense, and therefore, say, germs become less powerful in their lives and they're able to accept it.
So how do you tell a person with OCD, okay, who's OCD, that they have to take medicine? They're going to freak out even more at some point. At least my anxiety people do sometimes.
Well, and, you know, and that's the art of medicine, you know. You have to have that good bedside manner, and you have to weigh the pros and the cons. And oftentimes you ask the question, is it forever? And I say generally no. It's not forever. It's for maybe a year or two, and they're not going to go crazy. It doesn't mean they are crazy. It means, like you said, it's brain chemistry, and we're trying to help that initially so they're able to work better in therapy, so they're able to feel that relief. You know, my OCD patients, when their anxiety or their OCD is down, you know, they feel like a whole new person. And it's heartwarming to see that recovery process starting to take place. And then they leave me. All my patients abandon me because they go home. You know, we're a specialty center, so I don't get to follow them much after they leave. But
yeah, I know what you're talking about. I just had a girl referred for medication who was just absolutely paralyzed with anxiety, and we've been working together doing a lot of work, good work, but I just finally thought she just really needs, she'd have a relapse, and she's been on the medication. She came in this week, and she was, she's just like, I'm a different person. I can't even believe this is what it is to feel normal, and she was just so excited, and, you know, we were just hugging, and it was just a great party.
Well, and now, while she's feeling that sense of relief, now you can really do the work.
Really dig in and get
and really it. Dig in and cement recovery, or at least a, you know, much lower level of anxiety, and then, hopefully, she will not be on it the rest of her life. But, you know, in reality, there will be, some patients that do require medication, because I seldom see someone who just has OCD. I seldom see someone who just has an eating disorder, you know, or just depression. These days, they seem to have a whole conglomerate of symptoms, and it makes what we do very complex.
Yes. Well, can you explain to our listeners how these medications actually work in the central nervous system? Because everybody wants to know that. I mean, we've all heard the buzzword about serotonin and, you know, all that stuff. So how do they work? I know it's complex, but can you give us the simple version?
Absolutely. I look at... There's probably thousands of neurotransmitters in our brain, but I look at just a few of them specific to the medications I prescribe. So you mentioned serotonin, and that's a great place to start. I look at serotonin is a chemical in our brain. There's actually probably 40 or 50 subtypes of serotonin. And so we all have, and I'm making this up, we all have, say, serotonin A, B, and C. Some people are genetically wired more for depression. They may have a lack of C, you know, or a lack of B, or a lack of B and C. It's just that part of that genetic piece, how they're hardwired. Clearly, things like trauma and stress can seem to bring those things out. And so a serotonin deficiency syndrome, first of all, serotonin is an amino acid, and it comes from food. And so in eating disorder patients specifically, but in all patients, nutrition is so important, of having healthy nutrition. And oftentimes my anorexic patients, you know, they like to restrict, which means they don't eat enough calories. And the easiest thing they restrict are things like dairy and meat. Well, dairy is a rich source of tryptophan, and tryptophan in the body becomes serotonin, and serotonin is kind of one of our happy juices. You know, it helps relieve our anxiety and depression, and so that's where the food part comes in. Now, what a drug like Prozac does, again, I said earlier, they're selective serotonin, there's that S word, reuptake inhibitors. In the brain, they recycle, very green, recycle serotonin. Normally, when serotonin is released in our brain, it's broken down and it just goes through the system. What these medications do and all antidepressants, or most antidepressants do, is recycle the serotonin. And by recycling it, more of it's around, and the thought is that it helps with depression. When I talk about a serotonin deficiency syndrome, patients with that, and serotonin deficiency can come from malnutrition, stress, trauma, and think about stress in our lives today. I mean, who doesn't have stress? Some of us,
right. Okay.
But, you know, you take someone who's starving themselves, or someone who's in an abusive situation, or someone who's so
cortisol, they can't even keep up with it.
Right, exactly. Or college students, you know, that are working full-time and trying to go to college full-time. I mean, it's such a risk. And not getting enough sleep, you know. Who gets enough sleep these days, you know? We're just on the drive. So all those things deplete serotonin all by themselves. What the medications do, like Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Luvox, et cetera, increase serotonin. And the reason they're different goes back to that ABC concept. Prozac, for example, may increase serotonin B, C, and D, and I'm making this up just for an example. And Paxil may increase serotonin E, F, and G. And so that's why they're all a little bit different, but in theory they all work very similar. And I have no way today, we do not have the chemistry, we do not have the brain scans, the brain mapping, to be able to have a patient come in and say, oh, you're obviously deficient in Prozac, for example, or the serotonins that make up Prozac, and so you need 20, 30 milligrams of it.
Yeah.
But if you are deficient in serotonin, what a patient would look like in your office would be they would tend to have depression, tend to have anxiety,
right.
They may have panic or phobias, and clearly OCD.
Yeah.
And the other people we see with lack of serotonin are bulimics. And so that's why Prozac, for example, has been FDA approved, because it increases serotonin. And it does show a reduction, the studies showed that were done about 15 years ago, show a reduction in binging and purging. That being said, it doesn't mean that Paxil wouldn't have the same effect, or Zoloft or Luvox or whatever, but that's the only studies that have been done formally. Informally, in my center, I can tell you, you know, we individualize it based on tolerance, et cetera, et cetera. But serotonin is just one part of the picture. Another part of the picture could be norepinephrine. And that's, if you think of that, epinephrine is like adrenaline. You know, that's the buzz. You get, runners get the adrenaline. It's the fight or flight response when you're in a potentially dangerous situation. You'll have that boost of energy. But we see a lot of patients with norepinephrine deficiency, and they have problems with concentration, focus. This would be more of your... and I don't hear this word wrong, but I call it retarded depression. Mm. It's not that they're stupid, but they're just so shut down. Versus the anxious depression, remember I said before with serotonin deficiency, you would see depression and anxiety. This, you tend to see depression and the slows. And so they're just so shut down, can't. It's not they're running around their room getting nothing done, they're just... they want to sleep 24/7.
Yeah.
And so these patients would need medications that tend to have norepinephrine in them, which the old-fashioned antidepressants did. Medications that are newer today would be things like Effexor, which is venlafaxine, is the generic name. Prestique is a newer antidepressant, and its generic name is desvenlafaxine. Big words, huh? And then Cymbalta would be another one.
That's a new one, isn't it?
Pardon me?
Cymbalta?
Yes, Cymbalta is also like that. It actually increases both serotonin and norepinephrine.
Yes.
So it does both. And the neat thing is... you know, especially if you have that more retarded depression, or someone who's really, you know, and this is not due to malnutrition, this is, you know, the real deal depression, those medications may be a first line drug for them. And so those are the two biggies. The third one that I don't really have a magic pill for is there's GABA. And GABA in our brains, the medications called benzodiazepines that I mentioned earlier that are potentially habit-forming, if you take a benzodiazepine or alcohol for that matter, it turns on our GABA receptors, which decreases anxiety. So that's another big one. And then cortisol, which comes from stress, and that affects our hormones, that affects our sleep, that affects our anxiety, our mood, all of that, definitely a huge issue of study. I don't have a magic pill for that. I work on it indirectly. And that's where therapy can help again. You know, you can do relaxation therapy. You can do a lot of the CBT therapies or the dialectical behavioral therapies, working on that whole stress management piece.
Great. If you just tuned in today, my guest is Dr. Kevin Wandler, and we're talking about eating disorders and medication. So let me jump to this. All these medications, the SSRIs, most of our listeners have probably heard some of the names you've thrown out. What about the atypical antipsychotic medications? I know a lot of my clients that have been treated for eating disorders, and, you know, parents particularly freak out about this. You know, they put my kid on Prozac, but now they want to additionally give them something else, like Seroquel, and so they're very concerned about this. Could you talk a little bit about those medications and how they...
Yeah, absolutely. I guess this is the fifth big neurotransmitter is the dopamine one, and those medications work pretty heavily on dopamine. And if you have too much dopamine, let me back up, you get dopamine release whenever you experience pleasure, okay? And so if you think of someone who's manic and psychotic, possibly, you know, very elevated in mood, someone on cocaine, if you've ever seen that, or on crystal crack, all those things release dopamine to an excess that you can become psychotic. Where we use those atypical antipsychotics in very low doses. I mean, you use them normally if someone is truly schizophrenic or is bipolar with psychotic features. But we've seen that they really seem to help in OCD, which would fit many of my eating disorder patients. They also can help in some types of that real restless anxiety, especially in patients that for whatever reason could not tolerate an SSRI. They've been helpful in that. And the doses we tend to use in an eating disorder patient, or actually for anyone with like OCD, would be what I call really almost sub-therapeutic doses. So, medication like Zyprexa, for example, for schizophrenia, the dose may be 5 or 10 milligrams a day to start with. I would maybe use a quarter, you know, 1.25 milligrams a day. For another medication, I don't use a lot of Geodon because
Geodon, I was going to ask
about that. Yeah, Geodon can cause some EKG changes. That's the only negative of that for me. All of them can probably cause some weight gain, which I hate to talk about, but it's important.
Yeah, because who wants to hear that if they have an eating disorder?
That's right, exactly. You know, and so we try to look at the whole list of them and which ones tend to cause more weight gain than others. And I would tell you that Zyprexa and Risperdal, which are the first two of these that came out, tend to have more weight gain than Abilify or Geodon or Seroquel. And so I tend to if I'm not treating bipolar, if I'm not treating schizophrenia, if I don't see a lot of that at Ramuda, but if I'm treating OCD and mild anxiety and I don't want to go with an addicting medication, I would use low doses of those three. Geodon does have the warning, you have to look at the EKG, and I'm lucky because I'm in a hospital, so I get EKGs on everyone, and I can repeat it. But otherwise, they're really safe as long as they're monitored and used short term. This is not a lifelong thing. Short term, and short term is maybe for an OCD patient, maybe 6 months to a year. Right. I'm not talking 6 days. You know, because you're trying to get your client or patient enough reduction in anxiety that he or she is able to come into treatment
The best thing is for parents to just talk to the psychiatrist. Ask the right questions, and that's going to be real key, you know, to calm the parents' fears.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's so important that, you know, the parents find out, one is how often will they be monitored by the psychiatrist, two is the risk and benefit profile, you know, and really a short You need a plan to monitor the medication. Mm-hmm. And part of that risk with those atypical antipsychotics would include weight monitoring in general, you know, and clearly if doing a family history of is there type 2 diabetes, et cetera, in the family. But any antidepressant, too, I mean, a risk factor for all the regular antidepressants is that patients could actually become more suicidal, and that's kind of a paradox, because aren't I treating the patient if they're really depressed,
yes,
oftentimes for suicide? And so that warrants really close monitoring. The black box, what I liked about it, the FDA, you know, has their issues, but what I liked about it is it really brought to light that if you're putting someone on an antidepressant, there better be a good reason, and you better monitor that patient at least weekly for the first couple of months to make sure that they don't become increasingly suicidal or whatever.
Right.
Again, it depends what you're giving the medication for, but that's a concern. So,
we're out of time for today, unfortunately. You've got to come back.
I will. I can't believe 25 minutes flew by so quickly. So.
I know. Well, if folks want to contact you or get in touch with Maura Muta Ranch, tell us how they can best do that.
Two ways. Our 800 number is 800-445-1900, and our website is remutaranch.com, remudaranch.com.
Okay, is there a place on there they can see you or read about you? Or
yes, absolutely. I'm listed, obviously, as a staff member, okay. and there's a way to email us through there. So if any of your listeners have any questions, I'd be glad to try to help them out.
That's so great. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Rita.
Okay, God bless. Bye-bye.
God bless.
That's a wrap for our show today. Thanks so much for joining us. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.